Okay. All right. So, shall we have a go?
Let's do it.
All right.
I think we're live.
Okay. Hello, I'm Simon Merced, and it's time for another edition of Crave, the podcast about music and films and anything else which has been keeping me and Steve McCabe amused recently. We'll be talking about Crimson Peak, the new gothic horror. Is it really a horror? From Guillermo del Toro.
We've been to see Avalanche City.
With Benny Tipene along for the ride, by the way, and also Steve has seen Russell Brand as well.
Indeed. And so we'll start, as usual, with films. Crimson Peak, Simon. Proper horror or just a well-told story?
I don't think it's a proper horror. I tried to figure out what to call this, Steve. I wrote down too many words. Gothic, romantic, mystery, drama, with a dash of horror, yes. I wouldn't say that much, though. Well-crafted, superbly crafted. Just very quick idea of what's happening in the story. It's gothic, it's a Victorian. You've got this young woman called Edith, played by... Now, how's your Polish, Steve? Mia Wasikowska?
I'll take that. It's better than I could come up with. I was going to... Wasikowska? I don't know. Yeah, we know who you mean.
Anyway, Mia, who plays this young woman who's into writing books, and she's kind of not the biggest social butterfly in the world, a bit retiring, lives in the States with her father, gets swept off her feet by this English aristocrat, Thomas Sharp, played by Tom Hiddleston, taken back to England into this old house with the sister called Lucille, played by Jessica Chastain. And the story is all about what are the brother and sister really up to with Mia and her wealth? I don't want to give too much away, although I think the story is rather... Well, we'll get on to what the story's like. But anyway, yeah, Steve, there's no doubt about it. Beautiful to look at.
Oh, stunning, isn't it? I mean, you're right. The story itself is fairly rudimentary. It's a story we've seen in different versions and different formats a million times already. And so it's one of those cases where the destination's not really what's important here. It's how we get there. And I do think that Guillermo del Toro takes us on quite a wonderful journey as he leads us to Crimson Peak.
He does. The costumes, the sets, just his staging of the scenes is fantastic. There's absolutely no doubt about that. He lives up to his reputation as a real master of style. I think that's absolutely true. And I think he assembled a pretty good cast of actors, didn't he? I thought Mia Wasikowska, she does really well. I liked Jessica Chastain. I'm quite a fan of hers. I thought that the actor who plays the father of Mia, that's Jim Beaver, I really liked him. But what do you think about, Steve, what do you reckon about Tom Hiddleston? I have to admit, I keep seeing the character Loki that he played in those Marvel movies. I don't think I've quite moved on from there. How did you like him?
Oh, that's an awful shame. Yeah, I've seen some of the Marvel films of which you speak. And yeah, he's good in those, but I liked... There was a pleasingly low-key, there you go, but very present reptilian-ness to his character. We knew that he was not quite as charming as maybe he wanted us to believe. There was definitely a certain unpleasantness about him. And I really liked the way he played that. He could have gone full-on camp villain, and he didn't. He restrained it just enough to make him charming, but you knew there was something... not right.
Yeah. And as far as just back on the horror thing, look, there's not too much of it. There are some tense moments. I thought there was a really well staged and quite a gripping confrontation between two of the main characters right at the end of the film. I thought Del Toro handled that really, really well. But just back on this point about the story, Steve, it really didn't hold any surprises, the actual tale.
Yeah.
And because of that, I just wasn't quite engaging with it, perhaps as others have. I know this film has received some fantastic reviews. For me, though, I in a very, very cynical moment, Will you forgive me for this?
We'll have to see what you got to say first.
Well,
forgiveness withheld for the time being. Go for it.
Well, I wrote down in a rather cynical moment and Hammer Horror upgraded, which I think is perhaps a bit mean, but just in terms of where it's taking you, you may feel you've been there before, even though the way it's done is really well crafted. Is that mean? It is mean.
We have to be honest, don't we? Our journalistic integrity requires that we pull no punches here.
That's right.
It's not the most original story in the world. It's really not. There's a few nice twists that we shan't give away, but they don't really drive the story in any particularly exciting directions. I think you really have to focus on this as a visual treat. It is exquisite to look at. It really is.
I wrote down the word sumptuous. Was that good?
I'll take that. Yeah, there really is a beautiful color palette at work all the time. There is richness in the detail, the costumes, the scenery, everything about it is absolutely gorgeous. The acting's fantastic. You've got Jessica Chastain, as we mentioned. You know, we talked about her last week in The Martian. She's remaining rather excellent. She was altogether more vicious and evil.
She did that well. I agree.
She was quite wonderful, but yeah, it was more a question of how we're getting there. In the end, I have to make a quick confession here. I'm not really the man to be commenting on this film, am I? Because I had to bail out halfway through.
Oh, a bit more than halfway. Yes, you had a prior engagement. Yes. Look, the question is, would you buy a ticket? I guess. You know what? If I did see the trailer. And I wasn't sure I'd go see it just on the trailer.
Yeah.
But if you really do want that visual treat and you just want to enjoy the ride, I would say yes, see it. If you're looking for something different and surprising, you could pass on it. That would be my thought. There you go.
Sounds reasonable to me. Not having seen the end, I shall have to take your word for it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Steve. Yes. So I hope that doesn't put you off. So I have a qualified tick for Crimson Peak. Yeah, wonderful to look at. Now, there's another film I didn't get to see. You did, Steve, and this looks like I didn't see the trailer. It looks like a real fantasy full of costume and all sorts of wonderful visual effects. This is the film called Pan. Do you pan it or do you not?
I mean, this is one of those films, unfortunately, where the reviews are going to write themselves. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing I can do but pan it. I mean, you know, is it pan or is it pants? And quite frankly, the answer is very simple. It's pants. It really is. And it shouldn't be. It should be an absolutely wonderful film. It should have been superb. This is the backstory, the origin story of Peter Pan. And we have Hugh Jackman playing Bluebeard the Pirate, who gets a very, very passing mention. Very passing mention in the original source material from J.M. Barrie. But suddenly this is essentially his film. It's a story, allegedly, of how Blackbeard turns Peter into the Pan. And frankly, I wish he hadn't bothered. I took my daughter, who's 18 years old, who's right in maybe the tail end of the target audience for what is ostensibly a kid film to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And as we came out of the cinema, she turned to me and the look on her face said it all. She didn't even need to open her mouth. I knew that the film had lost her. It was disappointing, to say the least. I don't even know what the film was meant to be. It was all over the place. There was so much going on in it that was incoherent, that didn't make sense. Hugh Jackman chewed scenery like scenery has never been chewed before. What should have been a rich and full delivery of lines just felt like he shoved a mouthful of the pile of plums in his mouth. It was fruity beyond. It was horrendous. No, it just didn't work. There were ideas that should have been glorious. There's one much vaunted scene that, and this is not giving anything away, Jackman's talking about this scene in interviews at the beginning of the film, where he makes his grand first appearance in Neverland. in, incidentally, a mine where the Lost Boys are mining something called Pixium. Apparently it's pixie dust ore. We never really, except for one very, very oblique passing reference to how it keeps him young, we never even really know why they do this. It's just, it's something that they do because that's what the story says. So he arrives, comes in on his big flying sailing ship, big pirate flying pirate boat, and a bunch of young children start singing Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana.
Oh, no.
For absolutely no apparent reason.
Other than
they're chanting, hello, hello, how low. And you think, okay, this is an interesting idea. You know, we've seen things like this, for example, in A Knight's Tale, which opens with a jousting crowd singing We Will Rock You. We're thinking, okay, this is going to be clever. And then he does absolutely nothing whatsoever with it. Really, Joe Wright, the director, should kind of be a little bit ashamed of himself. He didn't know what film he was making. He tried to make about 17 different films at once. None of them work. I mean, there's things, for example, in the trailer. The trailer has a little sequence that suggests that a crucial part of the Peter Pan world, the Peter Pan universe, will be set up in the film. I'm going to imagine that people might actually pay their money and go and see this, so I'm not going to give spoilers away. But the crucial plot point, it's not just one of those scenes that often these days appears in a trailer and they never actually put in the film. It's actually an entire plot development that's teed up in the trailer they don't even get round to in the film. They obviously didn't know what they were doing.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
No,
oh.
This is not a good film. Apparently, I'm pleased to be able to report this, it's not just me. This film is, as you said, it's getting universally panned.
Hey, what is it about Peter Pan, Steve? Because I'm just, apart from that decades-old Walt Disney animated feature, which I think is beloved, I think, wasn't there a similarly panned live version with Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams quite a number of years ago called Hook?
There was indeed.
Yeah, and that didn't go down very well either from memory.
No, my favourite thing about that film was the fact that I saw it when I was living in Japan, and on the posters they transliterated it into Japanese phonemes, and the closest you can manage to the title in Japanese is Hook, which is an altogether more appropriate name for it, really. But that was better.
Oh, okay. Righto. All right. By the way, you are listening to Crave, our entertainment podcast with me, Simon Mercier, and with Steve McCabe. We've been talking about movies. Steve, let's move on to some live performances. Now, you caught a pretty big international name, especially in Britain, of course, but well-known all around the world, Russell Brand. He's been in town. I didn't get to see him. You did. What was he like?
Well, this is, in fact, why I had to duck out of Crimson Peak a little bit early. There was a mix-up with the tickets, and I got a phone call from the publicist telling me to come down the box office. So that's why I bolted out of Crimson Peak. And I have to say, I think I probably had the better evening. He's hysterically funny. He's filthy. He's absolutely disgustingly crude, violent, and vulgar. Is atrocious. The content matter is quite astonishingly vulgar. If he's not talking about a gay Adolf Hitler masturbating over a particularly gorgeous blonde Marine sergeant, then he's discussing why it is that Jesus was way more concerned with people coveting neighbours' oxes than he was with homosexuality. He's got one basic theme, really. He kept referring back to Hamilton being the chlamydia capital of New Zealand. This is a fact that clearly delighted him. But while he was hysterically funny, there was one major omission in the show. He's made his name recently, or he's remade his name in Britain, trying to set himself up as some sort of social activist. He's, you know, somebody's told him he looks a little bit like Jesus, so he needs to start acting like he is.
Right.
And he's tried, dare I say, rebranding himself. See what I did there, yeah?
Yeah,
he's tried rebranding himself as some sort of leather-trousered messiah.
Like, what are some of the issues in Britain he's been pushing? Is it like world hunger, that type of thing, or political corruption, or what?
Well, he speaks in very, very broad strokes about social inequality, in particular financial inequality. And he kept referring back to the fact that 50% of the world's wealth is in the hands of 80 people. And he kept referring back to this fact all the way through the show and never went anywhere with it. He was more concerned about the fact that the 80% of New Zealand's chlamydia is owned by 50% of the people in Hamilton. That was altogether more fascinating. He kept teasing it. The show opened with a little video montage of, you know, all the things that you're meant to be shocked by. You know, like people begging at the side of the streets, the disgraceful abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib. There's a little video montage of that. And you're thinking, okay, we're going to get social commentary here. And then, nah. He was taking the piss out of John Key, which in itself is a good thing. Don't get me wrong, but he never quite knew who he wanted to be.
Oh, okay. But generally, the people around you, were they lapping it up or not?
Howling with laughter. With laughter. He was extraordinarily well received. He is remarkably funny.
Okay.
Profoundly narcissistic. Much of the show was actually spent him critiquing his own previous performances on television, which was a little bit sort of self-referential and meta, but you go with it.
Yes.
What he does is, it was a 75-minute vanity project, really, for Russell Brand, but he's got an awful lot to be vain about, to be honest. I mean, the man oozes reptilian charisma and charm. He's not a man you would want to spend any time actually with, I don't think. Ooh, God, he might rub off onto you. Ooh, what a horrible thought.
But yes.
He is extraordinarily entertaining. There's no doubt about it.
Hey, should we just stay with some live entertainment? Because we both managed to catch some live New Zealand music. Nice to plug some local music.
Absolutely.
At Auckland's Mercury Theatre, an old theatre. Haven't been there for years, not since I was a kid, but we saw two acts, actually. First, Benny Tipene, he of X Factor fame, and then followed by Avalanche City, who've had a few top singles to their name. And a lot of young kids there in the audience, by the way, Steve. I even saw some parents dropping their kids off to collect them later. That's probably the Benny Tipene factor, I think. What do you reckon? Yeah, a couple of local homegrown talents. How did they go down with you?
I quite enjoyed it, to be honest. I got the impression, to be fair, that Benny Tipene's worst move, musically, if not professionally, was going on X Factor. Because you could tell that the songs that he'd done with that in mind and that had been edited and tailored by the X Factor people were kind of dull and kind of boring and oh, God, please let me be Ed Sheeran. And they didn't work. And then the stuff that he's obviously then said, right, screw it, I'm writing my own songs, were vastly superior when he actually got to be a guitar player. Because I think that's who he is, really. You know, X Factor have no interest in guitar players. They make him be a singer. But he's a bloody good guitarist.
Look, I should first up announce a little bit of a bias because I got to meet and interview Benny Tipene Steve when I was with Radio New Zealand Afternoons, and he came into the studio and did some live songs with Anika Moore. They were performing and touring together at that point. And I found him a really engaging young guy, a very unpretentious and disarming, likable, to be honest with you. And I thought some of that down-home sort of aspect to his personality came through on stage. The way he was chatting in between songs, it was just like you were maybe in his lounge having a bit of a yarn, a cup of tea. and the way he could just get some detail in there about this. He loved Dragon Ball Z as a kid, and that led to this one of the songs where he loved his cat, and that people loved that. Yeah, I think he connected with people quite well.
He's got a fairly effortless charm on stage, hasn't he? He's only young. He's about 25, is he?
Something like that, yeah.
But he has a stronger stage presence than you would imagine. I mean, when he first walked out on stage, I thought he looked a little bit like Elijah Wood in Lord of the Rings days. He had that sort of slightly hobbity look about him.
A tall hobbit.
Well, obviously.
Yes.
But nevertheless, there was that sort of slightly winsome look about him. And I'm thinking this is going to be unbearably twee. And yet he is so utterly ingenuous when he's talking about, for example, his cat. And he sings a song about his cat. It's done totally unironically. It's done so innocently that you can't help but get caught up in his charm.
Yeah, people were totally with him and were hanging on every line of that song. And in fact, I caught up with Would you believe I caught up with my barber after the show?
Hang on a second. You have a barber?
I do. He's in solid work every week.
His work cuts out within with you, hasn't he, mate?
He does. It's a short job, but anyway. Yes. A quick cut. But he really, the cat song was the one that he spoke about straight away without me prompting him, right. Just because it's so personal and everyone could relate to it. So that's quite a nice little knack, I guess, to be able to write something which just cuts to someone's own experience. Anyway, so Benny Tipene, he did a pretty good job. I think he played for about, 35 minutes? He did 9 or 10 songs.
Yeah, sounds about right.
And then Avalanche City come on. This is a band. What were your first impressions of Avalanche City?
Well, first of all, I'm going to correct you and say they're not even really a band, are they, to be honest? It's Dave Baxter and whoever's got backing him tonight,
yes.
Really.
Fair enough.
To be fair. Well, my first thought, basically, I was not impressed to begin with. I thought, basically, it's Benny Tipene with a backing band.
That's interesting. I'm kind of with you on that. I have to say, the first couple of songs, I found the beat of it, the rhythm of it, the way the drums were working was, there was a little bit of sameness to it, the first two or three. And I think the audience were a little quiet to begin with. In fact, he even made mention of that, and I think he was trying to G them up as he went through his set.
A little, yeah.
Yeah, but I have to say, as it progressed, I think people bought into it more and more. There were a couple of his more well-known songs towards the end, which really got people going. He's kind of an interesting stage presence, isn't he, Steve? He's got had his little skull cap on and his beard, and he moves in a kind of a staccato sort of a way. Not the most flamboyant performer, shall we say.
No, it's a very, very understated stage presence. And maybe you need slightly stronger tunes to back that up than he had, certainly to begin with. I reckon, though, to be fair, I think things kind of changed gear a little bit. Things kicked in, if you remember, when the band stepped away from their instruments. He picked up his electric guitar and sat down to start playing it. For me, that's when the show changed direction considerably, and I suddenly started to realise there's more going on here than I had discerned.
I agree with that, and he brought Benny Tipene back on, and they sounded really good together, I have to say. That worked well.
I always think that's a very, very brave move, to be fair, when a headline act brings a very, very successful and popular support act on to play with him. You're kind of taking your chances there, but I thought that was possibly the high point of the show. The two were a fantastic double act.
Yeah. Here's a question for you. Maybe it's my aging hearing, but I found Benny Tipene easier to listen to in terms of his vocals and his delivery of what he was saying. I found, whether it was the microphone or not, I found Dave's voice not so easy to pick out. So I tended to be able to engage more with Benny's voice. Was that just me, or did you pick up anything like that?
No, I'm going to say that was just you.
No, it was just me. There you go. Getting on a bit.
No, you see, that's why we do this as a double act, Simon. It's because we've both got so many different opinions and perceptions to bring to the table.
But look, there was people did get into it. There was some clapping later on, and there were the song that Love, 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 this was one of the big hits. People were totally into that.
Oh, definitely.
Streets was another song that went down really, really well. By the end of it, I thought, this is pretty good. They put on a good show. I thought the band was interesting. At one point, you had a trumpet player who I really liked. I thought he brought something different to the sound. At one point, he goes back and plays what it looked like from where I was sitting in an electronic xylophone.
Yes.
And then you had a guitar player who was also playing on some songs the electronic xylophone. Quite a bit of interesting little combinations going there.
It's rare for a band to have one xylophonist. For a band to have two, I think it's just showing off, quite frankly.
Well, you see, I made note of it. I wrote it down, so there you are.
It's remarkable. Speaking of making notes, one of the things I really liked about the show last night was how approachable the entire band were. At the end of the show, I ducked back into the auditorium to try and pick up a set list. And the guitarist, the xylophonist, David Love, his name is, he was just coming off stage, and I asked him if he could hand me a set list. And he did, and he also very obligingly wrote down the band members' names for me, which I thought was very decent of him. You know, they're very approachable people. So, incidentally, we should give credit to Sung Jin as the trumpet-playing xylophonist, or the xylophone-playing trumpeter, I think it's called.
yes.
The more appropriate emphasis. And then, as we made our way out of the theatre, it was an absolute scrum, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely. You know, the kids were there. They wanted the photographs. They wanted absolutely. Hey, what about the just? We haven't really talked too much about the actual music. I've heard it described as sort of an indie folk, yes. Rocky folk style. Especially those first couple of songs, I was almost brought to mind the Mumford and Sons type of approach. I think that lessened with me as the set went on. But what was your take on the actual music we were listening to?
Well, I think it's very telling that it's taken us this long in our review to actually get around to talking about the music. It is, with the greatest possible respect to Dave Baxter and his band, it's very pleasant, it's very agreeable, it's very polite music, but it lacks any real teeth, to be honest, doesn't it?
Kind of, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, he has a nice ear for melody. The arrangements were good, but, yeah, not a lot of guts there, perhaps, in terms of musically, yeah.
I mean, especially to begin with, as the show grew, by the time he played the last song in the set, Rabbit, which I thought was actually going to start off to be unbearably twee, the tinkling little xylophone part, that actually grew into something rather powerful by the end. I was quite impressed. It crescendoed quite elegantly. But yeah, to begin with, at least, I was thinking, yeah, okay, this is nice. This is all right. Yeah. By the time he reached the end of, you know, let's just mention this, by the way, hour and 10 minute set, little bit disappointing. But by the time he reached the end of it, I was starting to think, okay, I get it now. I see the point of this. It's understated, I think, is probably the most polite way of wording it.
Yeah. Would you go and see them again?
Don't think I would, to be honest. No, I'm not sure. It depends. I think possibly if I were more familiar with the music, if I was more familiar with their recordings,
yeah,
and I actually knew what I was listening to, I might get a lot more out of it. Going in cold, he's not enough of a performer really to win over new converts.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. I kind of tend to agree. I think I would see them again. I would see Benny Tippany again, and I would like to hear some of the songs he wrote with a full band.
Yes.
I think that could be quite special. Anyway, have I got time to just quickly mention another New Zealand album which I've been listening to in the last week or so?
It's a podcast, Simon. We've got all the time in the world.
Oh, excellent. Oh, I'm so used to having to look at the clock. It's been around for not that long now. This is the latest from the Canadian-born but New Zealand-based singer Tammy Nielsen, who... What I knew about her, I didn't know a heck of a lot about her, Steve. I knew she had a reputation of having a fantastic voice. And she'd had really a lot of success since coming here. I think she came here from about 2006 or 7, somewhere around about there. And she's won a lot of awards. I had a quick look at her website. She's been a APRA Silver Scroll winner. She's won Country Album of the Year 4 times, Best Female Artist 3 times.
And there's she's just showing off now. Really.
She's just showing off. She's got a big long list. And you find out that she's got a real pedigree behind her. Her family is a musical family. They played together as a group. They toured together. So she's been at home, on a stage, from a very, very young age. So I have to say, I'm not a big country music fan, and I hadn't really delved too deeply into her music. But I picked up this latest album. It's called Don't Be Afraid. And first of all, the first thing that hits you is, man, she's got a voice. She really, really has got a strong, powerful, evocative voice. International standard, no doubt about it. And I was expecting a country album. Well, there's some country here, but there's also some gospely blues, a Latin type song, and there's others which kind of evoke Amy Winehouse, I suppose, the title track especially. Not all of them worked for me. I'm, as I say, not so much a country fan, but there's some really classic songs. I like the gospely Bury My Body. And Steve, this is a we're talking about personal stuff before. This is a personal album. Her father, Ron, had obviously died not that long ago, and he'd played with them as a family group, and she kind of dedicated the album to him. And the last song is called The First Man.
Oh,
and it's just, I thought it was a standout song with really beautifully delivered lyrics, almost too touching. I lost my own father and my mum not that long ago, so I actually found it the first time quite hard to listen to it because it just stirred up so much emotion. But yeah, a lot of great material, not all to my taste, but look, she's covering a lot of ground, a lot of genres. I would really recommend Don't Be Afraid by Tammy Nielsen. Well worth a listen.
So it doesn't descend into the sort of the cliché twangy guitars and...
Not quite. No, there's actually a very good band. This production, I thought the production was good. Not a big band, you know, a lot of guitar. Recorded and produced in Lyttelton, which I think is becoming a real solid place to record, especially country music. You know, it's. I think it's got the number of artists have Marlon Williams, the other young New Zealand country singer. He's recorded music there. He actually features on one of the tracks here. Now the sound of it is good, and it's got an honest, direct production. Yeah, I don't have any problem about it being too smarmy and too syrupy at all. Even though one or two of the country songs, not quite to my taste.
So that's Tammy Wynette. Sorry, no, it's not. It's Tammy Nielsen.
Tammy Nielsen.
Tammy Nielsen.
Tammy Nielsen.
And the name of the album again?
Don't Be Afraid.
Don't Be Afraid. I shall track that one down.
Yeah, I think you would enjoy. There'd be a good at least half of this you'd like. Now. What else are we listening to? Anything else that struck your fancy the last few days, Steve?
I do believe that's been it, really, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'll have a few thoughts next week about the new Keith Richards album.
Ah, yeah. I know that that's had some quite good reviews. I haven't had a chance to catch it lately, but I might have a listen to that too. Also, we're going to check out some movies as well next time. I think this new Australian epic with Hugo Weaving sounds interesting, Steve. What's that one about again?
The Dressmaker. Is, from what I can tell in the trailer so far, about a dressmaker. It looks epic, it looks Hugo Weaving, it looks Australian. It looks like it could be an awful lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to that, and there's a few other films coming up soon. So, that is us. This has been Crave with Simon Mercer and Steve McCabe. You can always email us, by the way, at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, of course, or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Right, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.